Welcome to Light the Way, stories of one community's commitment to racial equity and integration, where people of all backgrounds are welcome and active in every aspect of civic life. Each interview in this limited edition series is a candid conversation that dives deep into personal experiences and shines a light on the relentless work of the South Orange Maplewood Community Coalition on Race over the last quarter century. I'm your host, Liz Testa, resident of these two towns and passionate about community building and equity for all. In this episode, I start to dig into what laid the foundation for young people like Solana, aka Grammy Award-winning artist SZA, to grow up in this beautifully diverse environment, even with the ongoing challenge of addressing systemic racism, and be able to take the unique experiences that shaped them out into the world. This episode features guest Abigail Pastor-Kotler, who moved here with her family in 1985. Raised to be an activist by her Puerto Rican mom, she soon saw racism and ethnic bias around her and got involved with the newly forming Friends and Neighbors, known as FAN, then the Board of Education, and the Community Coalition on Race, where she currently serves as a trustee. Abby joined me from Puerto Rico for this conversation, as you'll hear the Coquís making their music in the background at times, and she has lots to share about what it's been like to raise her family here and work tirelessly on behalf of justice for all. So let's jump in. Hey, everybody. Glad to be on the podcast with you today. I'm Liz Testa with the Community Coalition on Race, celebrating 25 years. And I'm so excited to be with Abby Kotler, who is a wonderful longtime member of the Board of Trustees and community member. And you're just going to really enjoy getting to know her and hearing her story. So let's jump right in. Hey, Abby, how are you?
Hey, how are you, Liz? I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah, it's so good
to be together.
Yes.
Happy to share my story.
Yes. And so as we're preparing to get started, you just have to say where you are, because as people are hearing a little chirping in the background, they need to know the context.
Right. That's a Coqui that's starting to be very happy because it rained today. And as it gets darker, they're happier. I'm in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. I'm in Rincón, Puerto Rico.
Excellent.
On the West Coast.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So, Abby, part of what we're doing, right, with the podcast is we just want to hear stories. We want to hear what it was like for you. First of all, what brought you to live in Maplewood, South Orange, you and your family? What drew you to choose it? And what was it like for you in these past years living here?
Well, actually, our choice to come to Maplewood was because my husband's family moved to Maplewood in 1969 from Brooklyn. And they moved to Maplewood because it had one of the few ethical culture societies within the town. And that was something they sought if they were going to move. So they moved there. And my husband liked it there. And he thought it was a good place to raise our children, even though there were stories about, you know, what it was like before, you know, even while they were still there, like when my husband's family got to Maplewood, the country club was still exclusive. Jews and Blacks were not allowed to be members.
Wow.
And that was, I'm saying, 69. So still in the 70s. I'm not sure when it ended. It could have been the early 80s because we didn't get there till 86, I think. But my mother-in-law tells me the story of how finally they allowed Blacks and Jews, and she was a librarian in Maplewood Library. And the women in the Maplewood Library didn't really get how offensive it was to my mother-in-law that even though the country club had been, excluding Blacks and Jews, and were now, even though they were now allowing them, she still didn't feel comfortable entering because it had just changed. But they voted to have their holiday party there anyway. I guess they really didn't hear her voice too loudly. And she decided, she was not happy about it. So she decided, even though she wasn't very religious, that she went out and bought the gauchest Star of David she could find. And she decided to wear that to the party. So in many ways, my mother-in-law was also an activist.
I was going to say, that's an act of resistance right there. Wow.
So she went, but she wore that Star of David.
Wow. So you all came to here in the mid 80s, it sounds like.
Yes.
Because that was where your...
My in-laws were, and we actually moved into there. Don had just gotten out of medical school and finished his residency at Long Island Jewish. And we wanted to live in this area. And we really didn't come with money to buy a house or anything. We had, you know, school loans, college loans, medical school loans. So we lived in their house for several years with my children. And then we bought our own house later. And also in Maplewood, but we lived with them for a few years. My older son started school from their house. My younger son started kindergarten. We moved to in our house in August. And Ezekiel started kindergarten that September.
Wow.
That's our story.
That's cool. So then how would you say living in this community has shaped you, shaped your children, your family? Just wondering how it's like, if you can reflect a little bit for us on how it's shaped
well,
you.
Well, I feel really happy that I was able to raise my children in a community that has a diverse population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the history of New Jersey is not exactly an integrated state. And where I grew up, there weren't a lot of people of color. And I really wanted my children. You know, I named them Joaquin and Ezekiel because I didn't want their names. I didn't want them to be Jose that was then made Joe, or Peter that was then Pedro that was then Peter. I wanted them to have their names,
mm-hmm.
be their names, you know, not changed. So, and I was pleased that my children were able to socialize with children from diverse backgrounds. That was important to me. And I was I felt that it was important to be able to live in a community that tackled issues of race. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really happy that we were able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that my kids knew that they lived in a community that tackled issues of race, you know, that it was important to me and it was important to them.
Yeah. Well, and also I think it's important, Abby, that we just name for our listeners that your family, your nuclear family, is multicultural. So.
Yes. My husband is a Brooklyn Jew, and I'm from Puerto Rican ancestors. Mm-hmm. My parents are from Puerto Rico. My father's from Mayagüez. My mother's from the mountains in Adjuntas. So, and I grew up speaking Spanish at home. I didn't learn English till I went to school. Mm-hmm. So we had a very mixed cultural family. As a matter of fact, I didn't really feel like I was an American. All my life growing up, because we spoke Spanish at home, we went to a Spanish-speaking church, and my mother would always talk about going back to Puerto Rico. She never felt comfortable in the States. She never felt like she belonged. My father didn't say that as much, but my mother did. And she would always say Los Americanos this and Los Americanos that, you know, and she would talk about Los Americanos. So I never realized I was one of Los Americanos until I went to Columbia, Medellin, Colombia, as an exchange student when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was there, they called me La Gringa. So I was mm-hmm. like, holy cow, I'm a,
right.
I'm American. That, and then I found myself defending, you know, America, you know, the States in some issues that we discussed. And I would, you know, one of the things I pointed out was, if I lived in Colombia at this time in my life, you know, I was in high school, and I said, and I was from the economic background that I am. I said, in your country, I wouldn't be going to college. I said, there's no compulsory education. Mm-hmm. There's only private schools. And I would not have had an education. So I feel very lucky to have been raised in America, is what I said to them. You know, and I said, I'm going to college on a scholarship. And that wouldn't have happened if I lived here. So to me, that was huge, because to me, the way up was always through education.
Yeah. Oh, that's I see a little bit of how you ended up doing what you did, what you've been doing in our community for so many decades. So that's a perfect segue, actually. So what led you to get involved with the coalition and stay committed for all these years? You have lots of things that you've done in the community. So I'm just wondering if you can share a little bit about that, how you started to get involved.
So in the late 80s and 90s, there were the community was changing, and I think some people got scared. It was the people were moving in from the neighboring cities, and some of them, and many of them were Blacks and people of color, and some whites started feeling uncomfortable. And so there were overt acts of racism and vandalism, houses, graffiti, nasty racist graffiti was written on people's houses, mainly Jews, Blacks, businesses. I know there was a business of an immigrant couple was targeted, and their windows every week were being shattered. It was the diner in Maplewood. You know, tires were slashed. So a group of us decided to form FAN, Friends and Neighbors. And I'm sure many people have spoken about Friends and Neighbors. And the first result of that meeting was, the first thing we did as a group was a diversity, kind of a diversity day. And for many years, we kept doing that. But some of us were also concerned about the schools, and we started another group called, so I was in both, but we started a group called USEEK, which was Urban Suburban Equal Education Committee. But it was the first time, I think, and maybe the only time, that a suburban group joined with surrounding cities, members, you know, community members of surrounding, so East Orange, Newark.
Oh, wow.
Orange, we met with them because Abbott versus Burke had just, the decision had just come out, Abbott versus Brown decision, and we lost federal money. We lost state and federal money, and so did they. And it was, how does this affect our community? How does this affect our schools? And we were educating ourselves and then educating people in our community to be advocates, what to be advocates for. And from there, they started, the diversity task force started. No, actually, yeah. And then there was also, an activist group, social activist group from FAN. A lot of those members were mixed. Mm-hmm. It was Shelley Slopkis, Jeff Grunewald, me, Ron Bayman. There were a lot of people who were involved, who worked with both groups. And then some of them became trustees, you know, created the coalition. The coalition came out of those groups. The UC group, we focused on educating ourselves on how to push to maintain an efficient education for all the students, which was supposed to be in the New Jersey Constitution, free, efficient education, free public school for 5 through 8. And that's when I decided also to, I was also by then on the board of ed. I ran in 91, and I served for 9 years. Wow. I had 3 terms. And my main concern was finding a way to provide a solid, excellent education for all students, despite the funding that we were losing, because we were losing a lot of funding.
And can you just, I'm sorry, Abby, can you just say for our listeners, why were you losing that funding?
Because that decision had just come down from the state, Abbott versus Burke decision, where we lost. They categorized towns and cities as urban, urban, suburban, and we were considered urban, suburban. But it was a time where they cut a lot of money from education, and mm-hmm. so we had to find our own ways to get the money. And of course, people, you know, taxes were high, and people were worried that it was even going to be worse. So people were against more programs, but we had an increasingly diverse a population that was increasing in diversity. We had many different nationalities coming in. Many different languages were spoken. So we needed ESL. We needed a lot of support programs. And I figured the best way for me to work on that was within being on the board. Of course, I was one of nine, but it was one way that I felt I could be an advocate.
Yeah. And you had your own background that you could, you had your own life experience right. that I would think was so helpful for that. That's great.
And one of the most glaring problems was the unequal access children of color had to educational programs and lack of access because of homogeneous grouping. Because what it meant, for example, students in elementary schools, students of color were underrepresented in the gifted program. They were also underrepresented in the higher level classes in the middle school. So by the time, so they were falling further and further behind. By the time they got to the high school, there was no way for them to get into honors programs or AP classes. So it was already, I felt, systemic racism.
Mm-hmm. And that's so hidden, right? So like you wouldn't even notice that until you're, it's too late almost, right? Because it's something that's kind of happening under the radar over a long right. period of time.
Right. And when I was on the board, when I first started, there were several of us who were already advocating for the end of homogeneous grouping. So imagine we're still dealing with that how many years later. And the superintendent, he had created a citizens group to study it, but then he changed, and I was on that committee before I was on the board, and then he changed it to deal with overcrowding and busing, and we could come up with ideas. But he also had a group of administrators and educators who he assigned to study grouping. They came back with a recommendation to undo grouping. They studied for over a year, and they came back with that recommendation, and the public went nuts.
Really?
It was, how is this going to affect my child? It's going to hurt my son academically or my daughter academically. Why would you mix us? Even though they came out with proof how all that stuff was not true and that both sides would actually, all kids would actually benefit, there was a huge backlash. So the superintendent shelved the report and decided he wasn't going to deal with it. But luckily, there were enough of us on the board. The superintendent then was Dr. Ralph Lieber. Then there were a few of us on the board who kept pushing for us to address the issue of access and equity, really, because that's what it was. You could call it what you want. You could call it homogeneous grouping was part of the problem. So from that, we had, he came, his plan was called Schools for Success. So, and he addressed it through, which we supported elementary, you know, programs for elementary school at-risk kids. We created a middle school intervention program. Yeah, we advocated for researching and maybe bringing in full-day kindergarten, which we already have. We created the parenting center. There were no social workers in the elementary school or in the middle schools. And it was a genius idea that Karen Weiland brought about when she presented it to the board, and we wholeheartedly supported her and pushed for it. We advocated for it because these were social work interns. So you had one social worker supervising them, but they did their internships in our schools, and it was free. And yeah, we were helping them and they were helping us. And as time mm-hmm. went on, then we officially hired, then, you know, mm-hmm. they were hired, you know, to be there. So it was something that I feel really great about, you know, that I advocated for a lot of those things. And even though change was slow, like we had contract for choice, which meant that middle school children could opt to move up a level. They could opt to move down a level too, but most, you know, opt to move to a different level. They would sign a contract, their parents would sign a contract, and it had to do with behavior and follow up and follow through. But the problem was, I think, administratively, they didn't get the support they were supposed to get. You know, it wasn't in place enough that some of these kids who really wanted to succeed but needed more help, they couldn't just get it from home. it wasn't in place in the schools itself. And so it was something that needed to take more time, and some of them were not as successful as they could have been. But little by little, you know, in elementary school, they got rid of it, and then middle school, and now they're addressing it in the high school too. So it took years. So we're still talking about it. And what? We're talking 22, and I got off the board in 2000. So imagine how long that has been. It's been it's been slow, but I feel like we set the stage. We set the stage for a lot of what's happening. You know,
it sounds like that was a really catalytic time where that group of you were really able to make some really important changes and additions, and, you know, really help to build out the resourcing for all of these newer people, students coming in.
Yeah. And when the coalition was the schools committee was advocating for it also, you know, and being very supportive, it was great to have a group from the community that felt like some of us did on the board. But then we got pushback from people who felt that and I was a liaison on the coalition at that time, a board liaison. And I had to get off because people complained that we were being political if we supported this group, which was ridiculous because we were talking about a group that was addressing race in the community, you know, the issues of race in the community. So it tells you where that people were at that time, how different it was. I think part of it was the fear of the unknown, fear of people, you know, coming in that were different from them. And also in the 80s, Maplewood was changing from, you know, I just want to go back. Maplewood was changing from Republican to Democrat for the first time.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So there was a political undercurrent of kind of shifting from
huge shifting.
One party
to
another.
Fact,
interesting.
Fred just mentioned recently that if you were registered Democrat in this town, your garbage may not get picked up at that time. That's how ingrained the politics were. It was real different. So people who live here now have no clue what those of us who came, you know, the pioneers, know what we set for them. Yeah, it was a very interesting place.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about you've really been such an important member of the Community Coalition on Race. So how did you then start to really get involved with, you've mentioned it just a little bit, but what was that transition from being sort of part of the community and then sort of kind of coming on board and being part of the Community Coalition on Race?
Well, I had friends who were also founding members. And so they always kept me informed about what was going on, what they were doing about the racial steering and about housing, you know, what was going on in Maplewood and South Orange at that time. So I was very happy always to hear that they were working on those issues. And I joined the schools committee right after I got off the board, even though I was a liaison for it on the schools committee also for a while. And that's pretty much where I started my involvement with the schools committee. It was like I loved working with schools and with young people. I mean, I was also involved with a group, it was called CPOC. I don't know if anybody's talked about CPOC. It was Concerned Parents of Color. And what we did was we mentored children of color in the schools. We each got assigned one child. My husband and I both did it. And plus we had programs for them. I know it was started by one of the Jaces, Milo, who is a councilwoman, her sister. That was partly her idea. And where it came, recreational events and barbecues and stuff to keep them busy and to keep us involved with them. So it was a really cool program. So I was always interested in working with kids. And I was always interested in working in the schools. So the schools committee was a perfect segue for me. And then in 2009, I was invited to be a member, a trustee. And that was my beginning. I worked in the arts. I was looking for committees to kind of be on. But I pretty much, even though I was in the arts and the residential, I just really love the school's committee and every and all the work. It's real, you know, tangible. You could feel it. Mm-hmm. And I was also on the, I've also been on the nominating committee, and now I'm on the history committee. But really, my whole tenure on the board has been with the school's committee. And of course, I support and work on a lot of the activities that we have, you know, the and some of the fundraising. So, I've been there a long time. And I'm happy that the school's committee is still working. I mean, we still have our work cut out, but we're still working on making sure that the schools work to close the achievement gap. That right now we're trying to make sure that not only the schools are integrated, but the classrooms. So it doesn't end, you know, you have to stay on top of it. And I like the fact that we create brochures now for people of color in the community who speak a different language. I've translated the brochures into Spanish, and someone else has translated them into Creole. Mm-hmm. And it's mainly on how to help your child be successful, how to be an advocate for your child. And then when COVID came, we also had something about COVID and what to do to keep yourself safe and about vaccine, you know, just information that we did as a, no, not the school's committee, but the coalition did as a public service. So.
Well, and Abby, I think that's so that, you know, coming from my own background, there's three languages spoken in our home, that just thinking about how important it is to have people that are on the inside, right, that are part of the board, that are part of the leadership, that can help to identify these places where there's that extra, it's an added measure of really important hospitality to community members. And so, you know, just as you and I were talking before we started the interview, you mentioned, you know, of like, you didn't speak English until you went to school and into grade school. And that, like, just that you have that experience, that's such a gift to the community to be able to, you know, to just like, you naturally understand what that's like, right? To have like a mom that would need that. She would benefit from having that in her own language to be able to read it, right? You say a little bit about like how that's been to sort of like create that culture where having things available in different languages, sort of addressing like we've got people from other countries, are kind of a global worldview. Can you talk a little bit about that, how that's been to sort of encourage that?
Well, when my mother spoke English and understood English, but she was intimidated. You know, when you go, it's intimidating to go where there's an administrator, or so it was hard for her when she had to go to the school and stuff. So we would go and translate, some of us would help my mother. And when I got on the school's committee, we started talking about how do we reach the people who don't speak English? Mm-hmm. And that was one of the ways we decided, you know, by translating the brochures and reaching out. And I've been to a couple of meetings where I've also translated the meeting, just in case there were parents, you know, live, just in case there were parents who didn't speak English. And I just think it's a great way to be an advocate for people who are trying to belong, who are just not on the inside.
Yeah.
Also
you talked about being intimidated, and I feel like, so my kids went to Seth Boyden, and one of the first things, I was made director of membership of the PTA, and the first thing I noticed was the brochure said PTA. Nowhere did it say parent teacher organization. So I was saying, for people from different cultures, whether they speak English or not speak English, they don't know that the P means them, that the parents are expected to be part of the school. Because in many global countries, other countries, global cultures, the teachers teach and the parents parent, right? And so there's not a connection that the parents are not expected, or do they, you know, they feel that intimidation of coming and like, who are they to come and tell the teachers?
Right. They have, like my parents was, you don't question whatever they decide, whatever they say, you know, they didn't know from being advocates. So you have to explain to them, you are your child's only advocate. Mm-hmm. And if you, and so you need to know what's going on and how to advocate for them. Right. So yeah, that was real important.
And then also
that's a real cultural thing.
Yes. And it can be then a sort of a preconceived notion then that the American based, maybe PTA people, right? PTA team thinks, oh, they're not interested, or they're kind of blowing it off, or they're just got something else going on. When actually they don't, either they don't know that it's an expectation. They don't know that they're invited. You talked about belonging, right? Like they don't know that they belong there. So they're staying away because in their home culture, that would be what was expected. So it's, I love that you've served as kind of a bridge, right?
And that's not all. I don't know if it changed. I don't know when it changed, but when I was, you know, when my kids were in school, the PTAs met during the day. So parents who worked, and some of them even worked two jobs, so they couldn't come at right. night, but parents who worked during the day, there was no way they could be on any PTA boards. So that also had to be talked about. I don't remember when it was changed. I don't remember the year. Carol might know that better than me, but that was a big thing.
It's so good. There's these things that, you know, just are sort of taken for granted, right?
That people take, exactly. And especially now.
Yes. And when you're talking about homogeneous,
I feel like
right?
we set the stage for so many things that now people, you know, it was, you know, maybe baby steps, but we were doing it. We were doing it slowly and working it all out. There was so much happening here. You had, also when I was on the board, we had a diversity task force coordinator. And one of the things I tried to push for her to do was mandatory cultural and diversity training for all mandatory for all teachers. And then I was told that you can't make it mandatory. And I kept asking, why? What if you give it as in-service? And what if they get credit for it? There's ways to do it. But then, you know, and I think they did that sometimes, but you still had people who felt, I felt like the people who needed it the most felt like they didn't need it and refused. And so they came with a closed mind anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't gonna. So as staff changed, I mean, I'm not saying everyone, there were some great, great people, but as staffs changed also, you had, you know, you looked for teachers.
Yep. Opportunity opened up, right? Yeah.
Right. But we still have a problem with, we still don't have enough people of color who are on the administration or who are or teachers. So children don't see themselves reflected in those who teach them.
And that's
so that's a problem. Yeah. And there, you know, we're trying to get some feedback as to why people, those who do come, don't stay. Mm. You know, and where recruiting is going on. And so the schools committee has been on top of that, you know, especially Sue and Carol and they've done a lot. I'm very one of the things I'm really proud about in the coalition is the schools committee. I think they hung in there for the fight all the time, and they do what they can. And yeah,
that's wonderful. So,
and I'm really happy that the coalition as a whole is working for, you know, housing justice and social justice, and that there are now these organizations like Soma Justice and Soma Action, they didn't exist. We didn't really have a lot of allies. It was just the coalition. So it's nice to see other organizations that also don't have their hands tied like we do in some ways because we're a nonprofit. So that's another thing I want to say people don't understand. The Community Coalition on Race is a nonprofit. There are things we can and can't do. Mm-hmm. But I'll go as an individual to support other activist organizations who are able to do more, even if it means a protest or it means, you know, I'm okay. You know, I love that exists. And sometimes that's what you got to do. You got to go a little further. But we're always there to educate and advocate. And we're respected by a lot of the town officials and the school officials. And they come to us when there are issues. They come to us for advice, which is something I'm very proud of. We're trusted. And we're able to be liaisons, you know, between groups sometimes. And it's a good feeling to know that we're respected as an organization that can help lead in when it comes to issues of race and in a time of crisis, also issues of race. I mean, because it's not always peaches and cream, you know, it's not always.
That's right.
It's so.
That's great. So I'm wondering if you can say what your hopes are for this community, for Maplewood South Orange, and all communities that are seeking to do the work of equity and inclusion. What are your hopes for the future?
My hope is that together, all these organizations will work together, not against each other. Mm. That everyone will realize that we're on the same page, that we want the same thing. There are different ways that people believe you can get there, and that we have to respect the different organizations' ways to get there, including the fact that we are a nonprofit, but we have been striving for a lot of the things that people have. So I would love to see, and I would love to see successes in fighting for participation in civic organizations, which is something that has come pretty far in this district. I think we still need to work together about justice in the schools, about, you know, the staffing and the administration. You worked with the student cooperative group. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was telling to hear the student collective. Yeah, the student collective. It was telling to hear that they still are facing some of the micro and macroaggressions that people were facing 10, 15, 20 years ago. And that needs to be acknowledged. I would love to see that teachers are willing to get involved in talking with students, understanding what it's like to be in somebody else's shoes, in these kids' shoes, and and how they perceive how the staff is treating them. Because some of them may not even realize things they say that offend them or discourage them from moving on. I would love to find a way for all the organizations to encourage social inclusion. Not just, you know, not living side by side, but interacting with diverse groups within your community. Because I think that's still something that is not happening that much in this community. I would love to see more people of color and white people mix, understand each other's cultures more. Because when you live it and you celebrate and you love together, you understand a lot more. And you're willing. There isn't the fear. I think a lot of racism is caused by fear of the unknown. And if we can erase the unknown, then we could have a lot more success. And I want to see us be an example for the state, the nation, and hopefully other places trying to do what we do locally. Because New Jersey still has major, major problems. And right now, I mean, look what's happening nationally. But I don't want to get discouraged, and I want people to feel that we can do it. We can do it if we work together. But I think we have to have the courage to speak up and teach people how to speak up, how to be allies, how to be advocates, and without offending, without scaring people, and just finding ways to help people understand.
Yeah, that's good too, Abby, because like the culture in our society in these last few years, especially, has been really divisive, right? It's like there's got to be a winner or a loser. It's either or. It's this like, you know, polarized, right? They use that word polarized. And what I'm hearing from you, this hope is that people can override all of that and come together and create this kind of holistic way of engaging with each other to
and
have
I wish
that. Go ahead.
In some ways, I feel social media has been harmful in that it allows false narrative, false stories, false rhetoric to get out there. And like this whole thing about what we're trying to bring into the schools when we're trying to teach the truth about the history of race is really just something we need to work on. And I would love for people to just find ways to talk to each other about that. Right now it's a little difficult. As words of encouragement,
yes,
I think people need to understand that change takes time. Getting rid of fear takes time, and change can happen more easily if we work together as a group and do not allow the powers that be, the evil powers that be, to separate us. Because people love powers that be love to divide and conquer. You know, and they try to make you know, LGBT the enemy, or you know, Latinos the enemy of the African, you know, Asians. Or it's just, we got to understand that we need to work together as a group, all together. We're all the same. We need to work together, and that's the way to succeed. Yeah. Rather than letting us get divided and only worry about ourselves. We need to work to worry about everyone, to push for equity, access, and justice, and economic equality for everyone. That's economic equality is a big issue right now.
Yeah.
And we need to fight for that for everyone.
Yeah, that's a beautiful vision. Abby, thank you so much. Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners? Anything you want to leave them with?
Yeah, just keep at it. I'm really happy that there's a younger generation moving into Maplewood that is super active and believes in a lot of the things that I and the Community Coalition on Race believe in. And they're willing to be activists. They're willing to put themselves on the line. And I just say, they give me hope. My kids, their generation, give me hope, because I think there's a lot more of them than of those who don't believe in equality, inequity, and access for all. So thank you to them.
Yeah.
Thank you, Liz.
So good to have you with us today, and with the little cookies in the background. I love it. Thanks so much for joining the podcast today. And for your many years of devoted service to our community, and especially through the schools, both from the being on the board and being on the schools committee. Really important work. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Liz. And thank you for your work.
Thanks for listening. I hope this conversation with Abby Pastor-Kotler has been an inspiration to you and challenged you to think about how you are helping to build a better, more equitable world wherever you are, for your family, your neighbors, your community, and beyond. This Light the Way podcast is brought to you by the Maplewood South Orange Community Coalition on Race, hosted by me, Liz Testa, and edited by Garrett Steyer. This limited edition series is produced in honor of the Coalition's 25th anniversary. Learn more at communitycoalitiononrace.org or find us any place you're on social. Until next time, remember, it's up to all of us to light the way toward a more equitable world.